For two painful years, the city of Boston was forced to relive the horror of the 2013 marathon bombings again and again. In the days following the bombing and the apprehension of Jahar Tsarnaev, then as he was tried, convicted, and eventually sentenced to death. Now, 5 years after that verdict, the victims' families and the city must revisit all of that pain and suffering again. On Friday, a panel of three federal appeals judges overturned Tsarnaev's death sentence. The guilty verdict and his life sentence still stands. And here with us to explain why the sentence was thrown out and what it means moving forward is Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be on.
And also joining us is WBUR reporter emeritus David Boeri. David, I love saying that. Welcome back to you.
Thank you very much, Jamie.
And you, listeners, what do you make of the decision? Do you have any questions about why the death penalty sentence was overturned, or do you want to see another death penalty trial for Jahar Tsarnaev? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Judge Gertner, I want to start with you. Just in simplest sense, why was this sentence overturned? What did the judges say?
Well, the opinion was very interesting. The opinion said that the first question was whether or not venue belonged in Boston. And while two of the judges thought that it could be fairly tried, the case could fairly be tried in Boston, one thought it could not, they went on to say, but if you're going to try it in Boston, essentially, it had to be a careful and searching voir dire, the questioning of the jurors. And then they went through the judges' questioning and the jurors that had been left on, and they said, this really doesn't pass constitution. This doesn't pass muster. This doesn't pass muster under the case law. And in particular, you as a reporter would understand this, the difference. If I asked, if the jurors were asked what the lawyers wanted them to ask, what the defense wanted them to ask, which is, what have you read about the case? Juror then has to say, well, I remember this detail, and yes, I remember the inadmissible evidence here, and yes, I remember the torture of this person, etc. But instead of asking the what question, what did you hear about the case, the judge said whether what you've heard would make it difficult to be a juror. That meant that the juror had to decide whether they were fair, and none of the parties had any idea what this juror had actually read, seen, or heard.
And David, I want to turn to you in just a second here and on this question of voir dire, but Judge Gertner, I just have one more follow-up on this point. Why not just throw out the whole thing completely? Like, isn't it the same jury who convicted him on the other charges that the judges upheld, so wouldn't follow that those same issues with the juror questioning would apply to the rest of the case?
There was no rest of the case. Sure, there was a trial on whether or not he committed the crime, but that trial began with his defense lawyer saying he did it. So the only purpose of the trial on the question of whether he did the crime was to let the jury, which would be the same in the penalty phase, know the details of the offense. That was the only purpose. So the issue here was not, you know, supporting a verdict that really, of whether or not he did it, guilt or innocence, because he conceded that.
Mm-hmm.
The only issue in this case was the death penalty, and that's the issue going forward.
So, David, you covered this trial extensively for WBUR. We were at the courthouse every single day for the station, you and I. And you had major concerns then, at the start of the trial, about voir dire. What were those concerns?
It's stunning. It's stunning, Jamie, to go back because I attended voir dire every day. And it's stunning to go back and to look at my notes at the time and my reports and to see that all these issues that were ruled on last week were evident at the time. So the defense wanted to move the trial outside of Boston. And O'Toole had ruled against them several times. But he kept on saying, well, we don't need to because the time-tested method for identifying prejudice and whether a juror could actually set aside his beliefs and apply the presumption of innocence is voir dire. And so O'Toole embraced the faith. And then
O'Toole being the judge in the case.
Judge, yeah. I'm sorry, George O'Toole.
And voir dire being the questioning of the jurors.
The close questioning of the jurors to find prejudice and whether there was prejudice. And so he embraces the faith and then he goes forth proclaiming that his questioning is thorough and searching and therefore there's no reason to do as the defense wants, which is to move the venue out because he's going to find pre-trial prejudice through voir dire. But you know, proclaiming juries to be impartial and fair doesn't make them so. And last week in the Court of Appeals, they found that the voir dire that he did was not searching and it wasn't thorough. And the problem was Judge O'Toole allowed only limited questioning by the defense, and he wasn't very good at asking the questions himself. So I go back and looked at my notes. And when he'd ask a potential juror, every juror, whether she or he presumed that Tsarnaev was guilty, he'd then ask, can you set aside your opinion? To one woman, and I have the quote here, he said, would you be able to discipline your mind so you can make a decision based on evidence presented at trial rather than ideas you came with? Now, who wants to give the answers, no, Your Honor, I can't discipline my mind, or no, I can't be unbiased? And in its order, the appeals court ruled, and I'm reading from it, the judge stopped Jahar's counsel from asking prospective jurors questions like, what did you know about the facts of this case before you came to court today, if anything, and what stands out in your mind from everything you have heard, read, or seen about the Boston Marathon bombing in the events that followed it? These are content questions, not just did you hear or see or read something.
So, Judge Gertner, how common is that for a judge in a case like this to ask these types of questions?
That's hard to know, but it's certainly the best practice. And it certainly was outlined in the case that the Court of Appeals cited, this Patriarca case from 50 years ago. I mean, literally, that we're in a situation, a high-profile situation, you don't want the jury to simply say, don't worry, Judge, I'm fair. You've got to know what they know. And I used to regularly ask that when I was on the bench. The issue here is if you don't ask the what question, you wind up with the juror who was basically hanging on every TV detail, mm-hmm. or the juror who saw, Tsarnaev confess where he had not been warned, an unconstitutional confession, or maybe a juror who actually, wound up just sort of seeing all the details of the offense over and over again. You needed to know, you're picking, let me put it this way, you're picking amongst a pool that was already filled with details of this offense, of this incident, and you needed to be able to make fine distinctions amongst them. And this question didn't enable that at all.
And Jamie, if I may here,
yes,
what the appeals court ruled last week is it is not up for the jurors to determine whether or not they're prejudiced. It's up to the judge to determine that. So, for instance, he'd ask Judge O'Toole would ask potential jurors, and most of whom said they presumed Tsarnaev was guilty, whether they could set their presumption aside. And so a defense attorney, Joshua Dubin, told me at the time, you know, you can't ask someone if they could put aside their opinion. Where are they going to put it? Into a secret box in their brain? But O'Toole was ever confident. He never tired of telling everyone that, in fact, it was working. The appeals court last week writes, and this is damning, despite his best intentions, O'Toole did not meet the standards. His performance fell short of promise. And what they've ruled is that O'Toole qualified jurors who had already formed an opinion about that Tsarnaev was guilty, and he did so because they said they could decide the case on the evidence. He did this with 9 of the 12 jurors.
Right, including the foreperson, or the juror who
right.
became the foreperson,
right.
number 286, right?
Woman. That's right.
She was a restaurant manager. David, remind us a little bit about her.
Well, early on, when she was just a prospective juror, her testimony jumped out at me because the judge asked her if she would have any trouble if the evidence led that way to imposing a death penalty, to voting for the death penalty. And she said, as a restaurant manager, you know what? I don't fire people. They fire themselves. They fire themselves because of what they do. And I thought that was a sort of a shocking rationale. It would have been very easy for her to do it. And it was suggesting some prejudice. She got on the panel, despite the fact that, as the defense pointed out in a motion that the judge ruled against, she had referred to Tsarnaev as human garbage in a social media post. And there was another juror, a water meter reader, who also was engaged with social media communications. And he denied that he was involved, and then a few things came out. But the judge never specified. He didn't hone in on just what it was.
Well, and when the defense came up with problems with the foreperson, said, you know, hey, she had misrepresented to you whether she was on social media, the judge refused to have an investigation.
So let me ask you this, though. I mean, this is a pretty high-profile trial. And so wouldn't a court have had trouble finding any impartial jurors anywhere in the immediate aftermath of the attack, the first terror attack on U.S. soil since 9/11? Or was this a uniquely difficult thing here in Boston, something like, what, 2 miles from the finish line itself?
In my view, it was in any high-profile case in general, right? And in particular, given the social media and the incredible intensity of coverage today, getting a fair juror is, of course, difficult. And that's why the questioning of jurors is all the more important. This case, however, was uniquely difficult. And so essentially what the Court of Appeals was saying is these errors in voir dire had a very different resonance now in this case with this jury. And these were not just little errors. I mean, they were major errors. The notion of not even investigating a juror who you can show lied to you or voir dire and didn't relate something on voir dire is a substantial error.
But there was a huge jury pool, Nancy. There was a huge pool. I'm not sure why they had to accept people who presumed he was guilty. They had enough people, enough in that pool that they could have presumed innocence and struck that from that direction to seat a jury.
They could have, yes. They could have. There's no question about it.
So, unfortunately, you know, the clock ticks by. So I do want to ask you both where this goes from here. So I noted at the top that the guilty verdict still stands. We talked about that a little bit. Does that mean he, Tsarnaev, if the federal government decides not to continue with another federal prosecution, death penalty prosecution, does his life without parole stand?
Yes. He's already admitted, he's already confessed. He's already essentially said he would accept life without parole. His lawyer said that on his behalf. So if there's no additional death penalty phase here, he would get life without parole. If there's an additional death penalty phase and the jury does not give him death, he gets life without parole. And the death phase will look very different than it did before because there was information about the confession. If you recall, there was a Waltham murder, a triple slaying. The victims had their throat cut. The older brother was associated with that, and more than just associated, the co-defendant with him, the guy who did the crime with him, confessed to the crime, told the police the details, told the feds.
That was Tadashev in Florida.
Tadashev,
right?
That's right. And the recordings of his confession were kept from the defense. And in fact, the government went so far as to say that really details of this particularly brutal killing should not go before the jury that was hearing death. The defense for Tsarnaev was saying they need to hear this because Tsarnaev wasn't involved in this slaying, but the fact that the younger brother wasn't involved, but the brutality of the slaying, the fact that the younger brother learned of it afterwards, raised the argument as to whether or not he thought he had no choice but to participate in this crime, else the same result would befall him. Whether a jury accepted that argument would be another question.
I do want to ask how ironclad this idea of life without parole is, because I know that that's one of the issues that sort of split victim families, right? The family of Martin Richard, the 8-year-old boy who was killed at the finish line, they were opposed to the death penalty because they didn't want these lengthy, long appeals. But there is something finite, right, about death. It's fine. It's done. And there's no possibility of any books being written or propaganda being spread. So I'm curious, is life without parole truly life without parole?
It is truly life without parole. I mean, those are the conditions. And heinous, cruel, depraved, absolutely he fits the bill. But the question here is whether to go forward, which they'll need to do if they want to impose the death penalty. And having been in that courtroom every day, and I know you were there, Jamie, it is striking. The trauma in that room is unforgettable to me as we speak. It was soul-searching pain that waved over the jurors. The jurors, reporters, courtroom personnel, all crying. I remember tapes of shrieking, of relentless shrieking that I can still hear. It was an experience that just drained the oxygen out of the room.
I remember, David. There were some videos that were so moving or horrific that they didn't even show us as the reporters.
Descriptions of blood falling out of the sky like debris. The question is, do you go forward? Well, there was a legitimate and understandable difference amongst victims and families. The Richards family submitted a letter before the trial began that the death penalty could bring years of appeals and reliving the most painful day of all our lives. We can only start rebuilding our lives and family when Tsarnaev fades from the media spotlight. Well, this unfortunately is what happens when you have the death penalty, that there are years and decades that go by and a tremendous expense. And this possibility that it's going to be overturned, there's going to be an appeal.
So I do want to play a little sound here. I spoke with Liz Norden. She's the mother of sons Paul and JP. They each lost a leg in the bombing, and she supported the death penalty. And here's what she said about the possibility of another trial.
You know, it's been 7 years, and we live it every day, but somewhat of normalcy has set in, and you can kind of move on and move forward, and then they have to go through it all over again. Really just sucks. So I will go. I went every day, almost every day, for the first trial and sat through it all, and I will do it again wherever it may be.
So in our final moments here, I'm just wondering from each of you what this will mean for the city of Boston going forward.
I think it's clear that it will mean another, tortured story. It would be one thing if going through this again would mean would be final, but there will be other appeals again if the verdict is the same. The system requires that when death is in the balance. You have to be able to exhaust your appeals. If it ends with now or ends with a verdict of life without parole, that will be the end. There's no question about that. That will be the end. Life without parole in the federal system means precisely that. And certainly someone accused of this kind of crime is not ever getting out.
David?
You look at the future here, and it may be imposed from the outside, or this may be influenced by external forces. You know, the president has already made his views clear.
Yeah, he wants there to be another death penalty do-over, as he calls it.
And he's waging a war on for law and order. And so he's made it clear what he wants to happen. And there's an election coming up, so that, there are external forces here. And there are people that legitimately want the death penalty. And as it raises deep, deep, deep questions. I mean, what is justice in the end? Seems to me that justice is Martin Richards coming to life and people being restored with legs and arms. We don't have justice in that sort, and we're not going to get it.
No, we'll never see justice in that sense, David. Thank you. It's WBUR reporter emeritus David Boeri. David, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thank you as well.
Thank you.
It's 91 days to the general election on November 3rd, and here at Radio Boston, we'll be focusing on a number of key races, including the race for the White House. For some conservatives, November 3rd is all about keeping President Trump in office. But for other lifelong Republicans, it's about getting him out.
There's mourning in America. And under the leadership of Donald Trump, our country is weaker and sicker and poorer. And now, Americans are asking, if we have another 4 years like this, will there even be an America?
That's a clip from an anti-Trump ad from the Lincoln Project, a political action committee made up of former and current members of the Republican Party who say the president doesn't represent their values or their party. Jennifer Horn is one of the co-founders of the Lincoln Project. She's a former chair of the New Hampshire GOP, and she joins us now on the line. Jennifer, thanks for joining us here on Radio Boston.
Jamie, thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be with you today.
Thanks for being here. So I want to ask you, you know, the Lincoln Project has led the way on organizing Never Trump Republicans around this idea of defeating the president. Why is this the issue that has united a sort of fractured Never Trump group together?
But you mean the Morning in America ad, the message in there? As I think that's been a unifying message, not just amongst Never Trumpers, frankly, but amongst people across the country, amongst Americans. You know, Donald Trump, if you've watched him for 4 years now, he's been a tragedy for this country one day after another on every issue. You can't point to a moment where Donald Trump as a leader and as a president has somehow done right by our country. But what we've seen over these past several months, as the president has not just mismanaged the pandemic and been incompetent in his handling of the pandemic, but he has been so narcissistic about it. He has been driven by ego and self-interest in the way that he has managed something that has now taken 154,000 American lives. I think that there is something that is there is something so tragic about that. And so I think it causes people truly to ache in their hearts when they think about it. And I think that's why we're seeing so many people come together. It's not just anti-Trumpers anymore. It's not Democrats. It's really grown to where the American people are looking at this president and realizing what a tragedy he has been for our country.
But why not simply switch parties and join the Democrats? I mean, I understand there are overall ideological differences between, you know, certain folks, the Lincoln Project and the Democratic Party. But isn't that effectively doing the same thing as what the Lincoln Project is doing?
No, I wouldn't say so at all. You know, I think that I think our country needs strong parties, multiple strong parties, two strong parties, three strong parties, where we can have, you know, engage in that exchange of ideas, where we can debate our differences of ideas when it comes to policy and legislation and things like that. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about trying to defeat a person who I believe poses an existential threat to the republic. We're not talking about a guy. Oh, we disagree with the Republican Party. Now we need to find another party. We're talking about somebody who is truly a threat to what America is and what so many have kind of always dreamed she can be. It's not about party politics. It's about country. It's about Constitution. It's about preserving the vision, not just that our founding fathers had for us, but the vision that we have for our children and our grandchildren and future generations.
But what do you say to his millions of supporters who argue that, mm-hmm. you know, what he's doing is speaking for them, and that until the pandemic, at least, he had a pretty clear case for re-election among his supporters, a strong economy, promising progress on a trade war with China, a crackdown on illegal immigration. How do you make the case to his supporters to turn away from what was otherwise successful presidency in their view?
Well, for starters, every leader always has some kind of base of support. Richard Nixon had a base of support until the day that he walked out the door of the White House. That doesn't mean that the 30% or the 28% who are diehard supporters are right. It doesn't, you know, my job is to make the argument to all of those Republicans and right-leaning independents out there who want to stay with their party, but look at the White House and know that they cannot stay with the president. And the argument, I think, frankly, is quite easy. This is a corrupt, mentally unstable, self-serving president who cannot lead, has proven he cannot lead, and continues to prove it every day. You know, just go back as recently as before the pandemic, when the president was impeached for trying to bribe essentially a foreign leader to help him get reelected, trying to bribe someone to come in from outside our country to come in and impact the outcome our presidential elections. So I don't think it's a difficult argument to make, frankly. And I think that one of the reasons that we've been successful in our efforts here at the Lincoln Project so far, at least, is because there are so many easy examples to refer to.
So these sort of ills of today, if that's a fair way to describe them, does the Republican Party itself have some culpability in paving the path to President Trump? This idea, you know, Peggy Noonan and the Wall Street Journal and others have argued that Trump and Trumpism didn't emerge in a vacuum, that he's grown out of decades of Republican orthodoxy, that the racial and social dog whistles and eventually bullhorns have all sort of led us to this president. You know, Nixon's Southern strategy, Reagan and the welfare queen, H.W. Bush and Willie Horton, W. and same-sex marriage constitutional amendment. What do you say to that critique that the Republican Party and members of the GOP and folks like you might bear responsibility for us getting to Donald Trump?
Yeah, I embrace it. I absolutely would. You know, Donald Trump didn't just happen overnight. There's no question that there's been this long path that has led us, you know, in this direction and landed us where we are today. And I would say that, you know, I'm somebody who was the chairman, a state chairman for the Republican Party. And I spent a great deal of my time as chairman trying to push back on what I thought were the weaknesses in our party. I spoke out against Donald Trump throughout that cycle. I publicly called as chairman for a change in our platform when it came to, you know, language that was excluding, you know, so many Americans from having equal rights. You know, I can go through the list of things where I've tried to speak up and tried to be that voice, but there is no question, you know, Stuart Stevens, you know, has a new book out called It Was All a Lie. Mm-hmm. Stuart, you know, like myself, Stuart actually much longer than I, you know, the idea that there were many of us who were involved in trying to advance Republican candidates and advance Republican principles, you know, have to look back and see, you know, so many examples where we thought we were just dealing with the fringe element of our party at times that has now sort of blossomed up and become such a vocal, influential voice within our party. I go back to what I said earlier, you know, it's tragic. It's heartbreaking for those of us who actually believe and embrace those principles that Abraham Lincoln spoke of so eloquently to look at our party today and see what we are. It's horrible. And to your point earlier, a lot of Republicans have left the party. We know that factually, as you look across the country at registration, a lot of Republicans have left the party.
So would it be fair to say a bit of this too is an attempt to perhaps right the party's wrongs of yesterday?
I hope so, but to be frank, I'm not sure. You know, I can't speak for everybody. I'm not sure that everybody here is looking at this as a way of saving the Republican Party. This is, as I said earlier, this is much more at this point about country than about party. Like I said, I think we need two strong parties, at least in this country. But if the Republican Party comes out of this, you know, destroyed and lost and they don't ever come back, it's their own fault.
So then actually to that point, Jennifer,
we're not here to save the party. We're here, we hope, to save the future of our country.
So let me ask you about the future of the party, though, because there is a sort of special strain of Republicanism that exists here in New England, right? The sort of, mm-hmm. Maybe it's a dying breed, but I'm thinking of the late Ed Brooke, African-American Republican senator from Massachusetts, or, of course, more recently, Charlie Baker, who is no fan of the president and didn't vote for him. Is there a path forward for a more moderate GOP here in New England, or is it Trump or bust or Biden or bust?
Well, you know what? I don't know if I can answer that question with any certainty from my own perspective, that's for sure. I think that if there is a path forward for the GOP, it's going to have to be one that is more inclusive, that is more embracing of the approach that people like Charlie Baker and, frankly, Kristi Noonan in New Hampshire and others who have, you know, made the attempt to be a more inclusive party than a more contemporary party. But let's be clear, you know, it's not, it really is, if we want to address the ills that we are confronting as a country today, it goes well up beyond the party issues. When we are confronting issues like the bigotry, the racial divisions that have exploded in our country and been manipulated by this president and take advantage of, the attacks on women, the hypocrisy on LGBTQ policy, in order for things like that to be defeated and to be put behind us permanently, that calls for all Americans to come together outside of their parties. That means that Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, Independents, Progressives, Conservatives, we've all got to be willing to say we may have our political differences on how best to accomplish certain things when it comes to policy, but we have got to come together on these big, deeply damaging issues that have the potential to destroy us as a nation.
Jennifer, we are running low on time here, and I want to make sure we get...
I truly believe the first step to that is to defeat Donald Trump in November.
So I want to ask you about that. The polls right now are just a snapshot in time, and we've seen polls be wrong. The president wins again in November. What does that mean for you, the Lincoln Project, the GOP? We saw what happened to a lot of never Trump politicians after 2016. They either fell in line or they retired and left politics.
Well, you know that all of us at the Lincoln Project have refused to fall in line. That's not going to happen. That's never going to happen with me. It's never going to happen with my associates at the Lincoln Project. And I refuse to even consider a world where Donald Trump is reelected until we get past November. Folks can go to lincolnproject.us to learn more about how to get involved with us. We are very focused. We know how to do this. Every single one of us are experienced in politics and campaigns and messaging and how to grow this kind of an effort. And frankly, the president makes it easy for us. I cannot argue that Donald Trump has been the most dangerous, most divisive, most unstable president of our times. And I do believe that the majority of Americans see the threat that he poses and are going to come together on Election Day and put country over party and put principle above politics.
All right. That's Jennifer Horn. She's co-founder of the Lincoln Project and former chair of the New Hampshire GOP. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And I should note that here on Radio Boston, we will continue to cover political races of all stripes. It's the first week of August. It's been mostly warm, clear. My phone tells me it's 91 degrees outside right now. Just a perfect New England summer. Of course, because of the coronavirus pandemic, most of us wear a mask whenever we leave the house. And the pandemic has changed so many aspects of our daily lives, including how we eat out and how we think about summer vacation. Maybe we're doing more staycations or day visits and road trips in our six beautiful New England states. Or maybe you're still trying to figure it out, where you want to go and how to get there. So we've brought in two people to discuss great places to travel and eat that aren't too far from home. Joining us now is Brenda Wynn. She's a Boston-based travel writer who runs Wandering Boston Eater, a travel and food Instagram. Brenda, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
And joining us from her RV somewhere in the wilds of Maine is Amy Traverso. She's senior food editor for Yankee Magazine. Amy, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
And you out there, give us a call. What are your favorite spots around New England? Have you made your travel plans and have you changed them already this summer? Are you revisiting any places that you haven't been for a while? Restaurants, day trips, week-long trips, you name it. Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I should note that there is a tropical storm headed our way midweek. But again, for the most part, it's been beautiful. So, Amy, tell us where you are right now and what you're doing in this RV.
So we're having a new experience this summer. We are having an RV trip up the coast of Maine all the way to the border of Canada. We got our COVID tests and headed north. It was partly in response to the fervent desire of one of our child who was really hoping for an RV trip, and we were kind of putting it off. And this year we pulled the trigger. And, you know, it's kind of a good year to be doing it because every vacation, I think, is more outdoor oriented than before, and this is a very outdoor oriented RV trip. And so right now I'm in Sebago Lake, which is kind of southern Maine, but tomorrow we'll be driving the entire down east trail up all the way to Eastport.
Sounds beautiful. Sampling the local flavors on the way, I'm sure.
Exactly.
And Brenda, how about you? How have you been thinking about this summer in the city and around the city?
So I've definitely been staying, you know, just in and around the city. I'm based here in Boston, and it's definitely been challenging because I have, you know, I often try to just go out and explore and travel abroad if I can. So this is definitely a different way of thinking about how to explore what has already been in front of us all along and seeing what may have been an area or a location that I've missed or overlooked, and taking the time to re-explore the beauties that New England has to offer.
So what have you re-explored?
So I've been doing just a lot around the city where I'm hanging out in the Charles, and I'll just do Island Creek oyster deliveries to my apartment. So in that way, I can just shuck some oysters just right by the water. Really taking advantage of just all the takeout that the restaurants are offering here in the city. Specifically at the beginning of quarantine, just, you know, getting the Blossom Bar cocktail mixers that were available and getting those, preparing some cocktails and just enjoying them just in an outdoor manner that may not have been applicable or something I would have really thought about previously. Trying to think of more picnic opportunities as well too. But you know, just really trying to explore just the parks and everything as well that we have, and making sure we're just maintaining safely with our distance as well too.
Right. Maintaining social distance, making sure we have our masks on. I want to invite our callers back here into this conversation. It's 1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. Call us up with some of your travel plans, your travel recommendations, cities and towns, places to visit here in New England during this pandemic summer. I want to go to Diana. She's calling from Burlington. Diana, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, how are you?
Great. So what's on your mind? Where are you traveling?
We've been traveling everywhere that we can by car within about an hour or two. So we do Maine a lot, and we do the local beaches when we can. But I have to say, I haven't been to the Vineyard in like 15 years. So recently we were there, had a wonderful time, and then went to Nantucket most recently as well. So I just feel like New England is a great place to explore towns, little, beautiful little towns. But also, it's a great time to explore it during the summer. It's the best time of the year. So I'm not sure why people go other places.
Well, this year it's a lot harder to go other places. Do you have any beach recommendations, yeah. Diana?
I love Cranes Beach. I'm a huge fan of the North Shore. You're so clean.
Singing in my heart.
The sand
here
is great. Yeah. I just wish that Wingashique wouldn't have the limitations on residents only. I see them as public beaches, and I really wish that they would open them up to all Mass residents. So.
Got it. Well, thank you, Diana. Thanks for the call. Amy, yeah, how about that? I mean, this idea that the beaches not everywhere are accessible to folks.
Yeah, that's really painful because our favorite day trip from Boston is up to Good Harbor Beach in Gloucester, and we sort of have our little ritual, and we're living without that this summer. And I think one of the great things about Boston is it's so easy to get out and to get into places like beautiful beaches or hikes. You know, as a city, it's so accessible to everything else. You know, I understand the desire to protect local residents. And I think probably people in these resort towns feel like they kind of give their town over to us every summer. And they, you know, they deal with the crowds and the congestion, and they know that their economy depends on it. And I think this year is a year where they're kind of saying, look, this is ours, and we want to be able to enjoy this and be safely distanced. And we can't do that if the whole world is showing up at our doorstep. So that's what's happening. I mean, you know, here in Maine, you have to have a COVID test to get in, or you have to agree to quarantine for 14 days. So, you know, we were aware of that when we made our travel plans and got tested. I kind of am pro anybody doing whatever they need to feel like they're keeping their community safe, but I do miss the beaches.
Yeah. 1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. Give us a call. What are you doing this summer here around New England? I want to go to Denise now. She's calling from West Newbury. Denise, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me. So we just finished our mid-Maine coast RV trip and did our Maine certificate of compliance and hit Cape Natick, Maine, the Dixon Family Campground, and had a great time there. And then went up to Poland Springs Campground in Poland, Maine, hit Sebago Lake also, and Grafton Knot State Park, which was just fantastic. And for food, you know, we cooked at the campsite, but got Glidden Point oysters from the Damariscotta River delivered right to the campsite for us.
Oh, so, you can do that? You can get it delivered to the campsite? Maybe I'm a camper
yes.
now.
overnight delivery. They deliver on Fridays if you place your order by noontime on Thursdays. And they're great cold water oysters, and they're just perfect. And it's just a great way to social distance. You're in your campsite. The campsites at those two campgrounds were ample, and there was a trail down to the lake, so we didn't even have to, you know, see people if we didn't want to.
Sounds lovely.
Threw the kayaks in, and you know, just spent the late afternoon, evening on the lake, and it was beautiful.
Sounds beautiful. Sounds beautiful. Thanks for the call. Brenda, I do want to turn to you on this idea, though, of what if you're not really like an outdoorsy person? What would you recommend for someone who, you know, likes the idea of oysters getting delivered to them in a tent, but doesn't like the idea of being in a tent?
That's totally fair, because I am that person. I have actually never gone camping in my life, and I think that maybe that will be something I explore at some point, but I've definitely been always more on the urban city side as well, too. So, you know, something that would be really fun that I've just been thinking a lot about is, you know, similarly, like, I'd love to go kayaking on the Charles, too. So how fun would it be if you got that Island Creek oyster delivery, you know, that next day delivery, brought some oysters out onto the Charles and just like shuck some oysters from your kayak or something as well too. Just getting really creative about, again, the space that we have here in the city, the ways that we can go outside the city too. So,
No, go ahead. You're just making me hungry here thinking about oysters. And I was going to ask Amy, she's in the land of the lobster roll. What makes a good lobster roll up there in Maine, Amy?
Oh boy, I have a whole treatise on what makes a good, if you want to hear, I'll make it quick. Okay,
yeah.
So we are going to be stopping at my personal favorite lobster shack is McClune's, which is in South Thomaston, Maine. Okay, here, quickly, I think a split top bun is great, although there's a place called the Clam Shack in Kennebunkport, which makes a fantastic lobster roll, and that is on a bun that they have made at a local bakery, so we make an exception for them. I believe that the mayo must be mixed with the lobster meat right before serving, or else it degrades the meat and it loses its flavor. So one thing I love about McClune's is they put the mayo in the bun as opposed to mixing it with the meat. So they treat it like a condiment, which is what it is. And so, and then also, I'm not a big fan of lettuce. I think lettuce gets slimy very quickly in the presence
filler.
Of mayonnaise. Yep, or hot butter. You don't need it. If you need something crunchy, maybe a little diced celery, but keep it kind of simple and perfect, because that's what makes the lobster roll so magical.
Yeah, then there's the only butter crowd. There's, you know, you could start a
war
here.
Okay, only butter. The thing with only butter is you need to have the meat has to be room temperature or slightly warmed. If it's cold, the butter congeals the second it hits the meat, and that doesn't work. But then on the other side, if you reheat the lobster and the butter, there's the risk of overcooking. So you want to be very gentle heat. Those are my tips.
It sounds delightful. I'm gonna follow you up there to Maine in an RV. I want to see if I can squeeze in one more call here. We have Lydia calling from Somerville. Hi, Lydia. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Where have you been going this summer?
Well, I've just been checking out more of the Mass Audubon wildlife reservation sites. Normally, pre-pandemic, I kind of just went to the obvious ones like Drumlin Farm or the Blue Hills. But since, you know, we've been at home, I've been looking for short day hikes kind of in and around Boston and in Massachusetts. And they have so many different sites that, like, I'd never even heard of on the north. And they break it down by region and North Shore, Central Mass, Western Mass, South Shore, and the Cape.
What's your favorite one that you've been to?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I love Joppa Flats. That's the only one that's not open. I love in Belmont, there's Habitat, which they have goats that you can go see. That's fun for kids, too. And then I'm really looking forward to, I want to check out the Daniel Webster site, which is on the South Shore in Marshfield.
And how are you viewing these sites differently this year with the pandemic?
Well, I feel like normally I kind of take Massachusetts landscape for granted, you know, because I'm so used to it. I grew up here and from here. But now with this pandemic, I'm kind of realizing that in these places that I don't normally think of as beautiful or as places to seek out, they really are beautiful. And kind of the smaller things, just like whether it's like a brook or a riverside or just like a grassy meadow, really are quite pretty.
That is beautiful. Thank you for the call, Lydia.
Amy,
Brenda, I've been doing that too a little bit. You know, we did a day trip to Essex and we went up to J.T. Farnham's and got a basket of fried clams and looked out over the saltwater estuary there and just enjoyed some time outside and also supporting, you know, a place that you remember from your childhood that you want to make sure is still there. Are you hearing that a lot from folks, people going out there trying to support the businesses and places that they love?
Yes, I'm seeing a lot of that. There are two other organizations that I think people have rediscovered. There's the Trustees of Reservations, which also is an organization that, you know, protects wild places, beautiful day trip destinations all over the state, and historic New England as well. There are a lot of historic homes that are doing limited tours right now. My favorite one is Beauport in Gloucester, just an incredibly beautiful waterfront home with an incredible history and the most beautiful room. So look into those if you're looking for day trips.
And there are places to go that are tea accessible and maybe not that expensive or fancy, right, Brenda?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, just right off the Red Line, you can just head over to Quincy and Wollaston Beach and, you know, go and get some fried clams there as well. So I recently went to Tony C's and just took my fried clams, sat out by Wollaston and just looked out into the water. Not too far away from Wollaston and Quincy are the quarries as well, which are just really beautiful to just do like a little climb as well too. And it just has all this street art and graffiti there. So it's just visually stimulating.
So you don't have to rent an RV.
Yes.
Sorry,
and
go ahead, Amy.
The Harbor Islands are another sort of accessible destination right out of Boston. When I used to live in the North End and didn't own a car, I would just hop on a boat and go out to the Harbor Islands for the day. It's really affordable and it's just gorgeous out there. And you get a boat ride.
Yeah, it's a win-win. And Brenda, we only have a few seconds left here, but I do understand that Boston's losing you, a lifelong New Englander. So
yes.
Has that made you see things in a different lens?
Oh, absolutely. So this is actually my last week in Boston right now, and I am about to take the Amtrak out to the West Coast to move to San Francisco. So I think that in itself is going to be a really different experience in terms of how I chose to travel for this move and try to also maintain safety. So I decided to go on the route with the train so that way I could still be able to see the sights along the way and, you know, go through the Rockies and see the sights from the Amtrak. And it's going to be really hard for me to leave Boston, but it's definitely making me just see the city in a whole different light, see New England in a different light, and just really taking it all in and, you know, just re-exploring all the beauty that I may have missed all along.
Well, Brenda, we'll miss you here at Radio Boston. That's
thank you.
That's Brenda Wynn. She's a, for this week, Boston-based travel writer who runs Wandering Boston Eater. It's a travel and food Instagram. Brenda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us was Amy Traverso. She's a senior food editor for Yankee Magazine, joining us from her RV in Maine. Amy, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.